Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today we're leaving South Central behind and drifting out to Western Alaska and salmon-rich Bristol Bay. We're going there to tell you about a project to save the stories and the significant historical meaning behind one of the premier salmon canneries in Alaska, the Naknek Cannery in South Naknek. We have guides to take us there, public historian Katie Ringsmith, fellow historian and author Tim Troll, and artist Andrew Abayo. They are all collaborators with many others on the Naknek Cannery History Project, which has several goals: getting the cannery district registered with the National Registry of Historic Places, creating an upcoming museum exhibit in the Alaska State Museum in Juneau, and leading area youth through a digital storytelling project to preserve history and stories. We all know salmon is an icon of Alaska, but what of the people who made that salmon explosion happen? And how did we change over time as people from all over the world work side by side on the slime lines of Bristol Bay? And perhaps most importantly, how did the Spanish influenza epidemic, which hit all of Alaska, but really did devastating damage to Western Alaska in 1919, how did that influence the story? I want to invite you to check out our website at alaskapublic.org. Just select radio, scroll down to Hometown Alaska, and today's webpage will show up. And we've got some historical documents on there, including a report on the 1919 influenza epidemic and some of the history of the Alaska Packers Association. So if you get interested, you can dig further on our website. I also want to invite people to go ahead and participate in this conversation. Maybe you worked in a cannery in Bristol Bay at some point, or you know, maybe your family comes from Bristol Bay. So we'd love to hear from you at 550-8433 in Anchorage. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So now I'm just going to introduce our guests. I'm going to start with Katie because I heard about this project through Katie, and you have this enormous resume, Katie. you teach American and Alaska history at the University of Alaska Anchorage. You are creator of Tundra Vision, which gives public history talks that I've been to, and you also, your dad, Gary Johnson, was the bookkeeper at South Naknek, the cannery we're talking about, in 1975, and he worked his way up to become superintendent, and he worked there from as a superintendent from 79 to 97. So Katie, your life was folded into the Naknek Cannery, where you were a slimer, you were an egg packer and a bowl cook. So I think you have a basis for which to talk about this history project a little bit.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for having us. This is literally a labor of love, a story of work
lots
in Alaska
of work.
Canneries,
yeah.
Right.
Let me introduce Tim, yeah. and Andrew before we get going. Tim, I have you as the publisher of two books on Bristol Bay history, Sailing for Salmon, The Early Years of Commercial Fishing in Alaska Bristol Bay, and Our Story, Readings from Southwest, co-edited with National Park historian John Branson.
John Branson. Mm-hmm.
And I know that you are a storyteller and a lover of Bristol Bay, and we will be talking about the Spanish influenza and as it affected Bristol Bay, and we'll be coming to you definitely for some information about
it. All right,
that.
I'll tell you what I can.
Pretty dramatic story. And then we are very lucky to have Andrew Abayo with us today. He is kind of an artistic and cultural contributor to this project, and he's building a model of the Naknek Cannery, which is probably going to fill a whole tabletop.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought a little piece. We don't have pictures to show on the radio,
yes.
But he said he spent 8 hours yesterday building the beginnings of it, and he laid it out on a giant, what would you call that, a map of the
plat
of
1979.
And this is bound for the museum exhibit in Juneau called Mug Up, right?
Yes, it is.
So you have hours and hours of work, but you said it's a pleasure.
Yes, for me to see the plat and to learn from it, and we actually toured it about 3 months ago, I believe. And so I just wanted to make a mock-up yesterday to kind of wrap my head around how it's going to look and get a feel for it. And I was pleased with how it turned out. So
yeah,
I'm excited to start on the actual project, and
I am sure images of this will eventually, you know, percolate out. So it's really cool. It's just because I've seen pictures, but to see the model, it's a huge footprint. This cannery had a huge footprint in that mm-hmm. area. So back to you, Katie. I'm going to start with what is the NACNA Cannery History Project? Just tell us about it, and I'm going to invite Tim and Andrew to chime in. But okay. What's the scope of it? You know, you've been working on it for years, and what's your timeline to create this exhibit and things like that?
Okay, well, the NN Cannery History Project, and first of all, NN means NACNIC. The Alaska packers that built many canneries in Alaska used the diamond canneries, really as a bookkeeping technique. So the symbol, which looks like a diamond, actually is like how we use email today, at. So NN meant at NACNIC, and it was the first cannery on the NACNIC River. So this cannery is actually in the village of South NACNIC. Mm-hmm. And so it's the NN Cannery History Project. And we were at a conference. My colleague Bob King, Tim was there. We were in Cordova in 2015. And word spread that Trident Seafoods, which is the current owner of the cannery, had decided to close this cannery permanently. And this is after, you know, 130 years of working, canning fish. And so Bob King and I, we thought we had to do something. And so ultimately what we decided to do was the NN Cannery History Project. So this is a grassroots project, but we have brought together some pretty big partners to help us pursue this.
Yeah, you have about 15 partners, I think, I saw on your website.
Yes, so everyone from Trident Seafoods, which is the biggest seafood company in America, to the National Park Service, to the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, of course, the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust. We have the Bristol Bay Borough on board. The Bristol Bay Native Corporation has been supportive of this project. We actually just found out about another grant through the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. So this is a project people seem to really believe in. And our goal was to, first of all, get the cannery nominated on the National Register to recognize its value to our nation's history, specifically as a maritime site. We wanted to also be able to have a legacy component of this. So we are working with Sea Stories, which is a local digital storytelling.
SEE Stories.
Yep, Sea Stories, yeah. Marie Aisma. And she's going to go out there in 2 weeks to do a workshop, a storytelling workshop with the Bristol Bay School District students. So we'll have about 19 kids who will produce digital shorts. And
Will they be interviewing residents?
It's exactly what they're going to be doing, all through the context of work and cannery working and the stories of the canneries. And then thirdly, we are working with the University of Alaska Fairbanks to produce a project jukebox that involves interviews of 10 different cannery workers. And then ultimately, we want to do an exhibit. So we're working with the State Museum in Juneau to produce a world-class exhibition called Mug Up. And the whole point to all of this is to tell the often forgotten stories of the cannery workers, the people who worked in canneries like the NN and who contributed to one of Alaska's most significant industries.
Yeah. Now, let me just let Andrew and Tim chime in here about the project. I mean, you're building, Andrew, I'm looking at you, you're
yes.
building the model of what it looks like a little city, really.
Yes.
But what is your connection to the project? You're contributing that, but what else?
So what got me started with this project is I've worked with Katie before and on another project. And so I'm from Pilot Point and grew up commercial fishing first with my mom on the set net and then with my dad on a drift boat. And so fishing has always been a part of me, and the cannery was in operation at some point, but not at a full capacity like it was in the 1900s. So I'm always fascinated with history. And so I always thought to myself, and I'm researching about Pilot Point and the cannery, and I have always wanted to build a model of Pilot Point cannery.
And
and so I seen, like, on social media, Katie's sharing of her research for canneries and boats and fishermen and also the cannery workers, of course.
Did you have family that worked in the cannery? Don't know.
Mostly just fishing. Yes.
Fishing. Mostly fishing. Not really
well,
working.
And my dad worked with his relatives, too, because he was originally started out at Pilot Point.
Who did?
My dad did.
Your dad started at Pilot Point.
With
so
APA.
He knew your family. Yep. And yeah. Tim, just a little bit from you on how you got involved with this.
In the
Cannery Project and, you know, kind of what's important about it to you.
Well, I used to live out in Dillingham for many years, and you can't live out there and, one, not be aware of fish. And then gradually, what's the history of these canneries? What are these old boats lying back here in the weeds? Why is this place called Sheep Island? When I'd ask around about that, oh, that's because the cannery held their sheep. That's where they grazed their sheep. And there are no sheep around Dillingham, so that these traces are all there.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's a history that's been continuous now for well over 130 years.
And you're the executive director of the Bristol Bay Land Heritage...
Heritage Land Trust.
Heritage. Right. And what is the mission of that group?
We're primarily a conservation group, trying to conserve lands out in Bristol Bay. But from my perspective, what encourages conservation is making people aware of their long history in a place. And it's the place that's important. And, of course, commercial fishing is a big part of
it. And the history and the stories give it meaning.
And the stories, yes.
If the stories are lost, when you arrive at a place, you don't have a sense of what all has gone on there, right? Mm-hmm. I also thought it would be really important for us to... talk about the Alaska Packers Association, because they were so influential in the salmon fishing industry. And by the way, I don't know that we gave the date when the NN Cannery opened. It's 1891, something like that?
Yeah, the NN Cannery actually started as a saltery, which was built before the Alaska Packers even formed. It was built by Arctic Packing, which is a California company, and they came up to salt
Before canning.
Before, and we actually have the remains of the old saltery that still exist at the cannery. And then many of the companies began to consolidate, and one of the companies that began to buy out a whole bunch of the canneries manifest as the Alaska Packers Association in the early 1890s. And one of the first, they built hundreds of canneries throughout Alaska. And the first cannery on the Naknek, the Alaska Packers built, they absorbed part of the Arctic Packing, and then they built the cannery right where the saltery was. And that was in 1895. So they've been canning fish pretty much right up until the 1990s, every single summer, with the exception of a couple years in World War II. Mm-hmm. So the NN Cannery perhaps is not the oldest cannery in Alaska, but it's pretty, and I know all my Kodiak friends are going to be rolling their eyes, but I would argue that it is one of the most historically significant canneries in Alaska, simply because it probably canned more salmon than any cannery in Alaska. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important to note. I think the industry got started in Bristol Bay in 1884 on the Nooshigak side. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about the NN Cannery is that it seems to be one of the more intact, not only from the point of view of production, but from history. Mm-hmm. So you have an intact cannery that still has these old buildings that go back to when it first started in 1895, and we don't see that in many canneries.
Many cannery places, yeah.
It still has its intact Chinese bunkhouses. It still has the houses that used to separate the different groups via mess hall. And then so we can see also when the egg house came along. So you can tell the history, 100 years of canning fish in Alaska through one place.
Yeah. Let me throw out our phone numbers here just in case people would like to join this conversation. In Anchorage, it's 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. Or we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And again, we're talking about the Naknek Cannery and a expansive and energetic and grassroots project to save the history in many different ways. We have Katie Ringsmuth, Tim Troll, and Andrew Abaya with us here. And we're just talking a little bit about the Alaska Packers Association. From the reading I did to get ready for the show, they were a tremendous force in Alaska, even in territorial days, right? Mm-hmm. And that they were very political, that they were very capitalistic. They were, you know, and even that when they first arrived, maybe the salmon canning was not, the fish weren't being, too much canning was, they came in and organized the canning in some way. Mm-hmm. And I also was curious, I think there was something like 19 canneries that they operated. And that would have been up in the Bristol Bay area and down on the Kenai?
Yeah, they probably had more than 19.
Maybe more than 19?
And a lot of canneries they bought, they told not to process. So,
see, that's what I'm getting at. I remember reading something like that.
Yeah, so essentially they paid some not to process. So in other words, they didn't want to have a glut on the market.
Right.
But the most thing that most Alaskans know about the Alaska Packers is that they use fish traps.
Oh.
And so much of the story for Alaskans anyway, especially when it comes to Alaska Packers, is in the context of statehood and the fact that there was a huge battle with the Alaska. And the Alaska Packers had some powerful lawyers that really prevented Alaska from becoming a state for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether it was Greening, Bartlett, they railed against the Alaska Packers and where the fish trap became kind of the icon of the statehood movement.
Mm-hmm.
And which is certainly important, but it's not the only story.
Right.
Because I think what gets forgotten in that are all of the people who worked at these places.
Right. And that I want to get it into the workforce, because to me that's one of the most surprising things. I mean, I always knew that there had been cannery workers from the Philippines. I remember reading back to the whaling days about whaling ships coming around to go up into the Bering Sea and stopping in the Philippines and picking up fishermen called Manila men,
mm-hmm.
that ended up working in the whaling fields,
yeah.
right? So I've always known that there's been a strong historical Philippine community in Alaska. But I had no idea, for example, that there were Croatians and Portuguese. So let's talk a little bit about that. And maybe in the context of the Naknek cannery. And we'll get to your story too, Katie, because you kind of grew up there. But jump forward and tell us what you saw when you were there. People had the housing, different groups slept in different buildings, they ate in different areas. It was a different time, right?
Well, when I was there, actually a lot of the place
already?
Had been desegregated, and almost 50% of the workforce were women.
That's a huge change.
Yeah,
from,
it is.
Yeah.
But a generation before me, that segregation certainly existed.
Mm-hmm.
So we use the term mug up. And as someone who's ever worked on a slime line or worked on a patching line, when you hear that whistle blow, it is utter relief because you have no sense of time. Right, the clock doesn't matter. The really only sense of time you have is looking at that river, the tides that move up and down. And when that whistle blows, you know you can take a 10-15 minute break. And you go out there on the dock. And what has always struck me is how many different languages that you hear on the dock at Mug Up. And if you take the historical view, you would have had Chinese people, on that dock at one point in time. You also had Japanese, you had Filipinos, which are most people who study this know about them. But one of the things that we're realizing is that the largest number of people who worked at this cannery were Mexicans.
That's a curious thing, right?
Yeah. And again, it speaks to the story of the Alaska Packers Association. So the parent company was Del Monte. And of course, Del Monte fish was just one thing they were canning. They were out of California, San Francisco area. The Starfleet was out of Oakland. And many of the people that they were getting to work in Alaska canneries were coming out of Central California, where they were canning, the vegetables and the fruits
mm-hmm.
that they grew in the valley there. So it's actually not that surprising that there would be a number of Mexican people who worked in Alaska. But what's interesting is how forgotten
right.
They are.
Right.
Whereas we do remember the Chinese, for example. We do remember the Japanese. And, of course, the Filipinos still remain an important
right.
Contributor to the cannery scene. So the Mexicans have been forgotten. That's one of the reasons why we want to make sure we bring these voices back to our history.
Um, One question I have is, you read about so many groups from outside, but what about Alaska Natives and what role did they play in the cannery? And it probably shifted over time, but tell us about that. Well, and Andrew, you maybe chime in too.
Yeah, definitely in the canneries, the Alaska Native people were important. There's a lot of history in terms of who was paid and how that all worked out. But what I find, and the story that I really want to tell with this project, is what happened when the temporary crews left. And you did have people who were there and the very important and vital job of taking care of these canneries not only take care of them in the winter, to continue the maintenance on those canneries, but also to ready them in the spring when the crews came back.
So it was, only a 3 month or what, 4 or 5 month process when it was actually going full bore.
Right.
Go ahead, Andrew. Do you want to chime in?
Oh yeah, I know that there was Native population there, and they were a part of the winter watchman crew.
Yeah, yeah.
My grandpa Alec Abayo, he was a commercial fisherman down there in the sailboat days.
Which is hard to imagine, right? In sailboat days for fishing.
Yeah. Yes. So it's great to hear these stories come alive.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm excited.
We are going to take a tiny break right now, and we'll be right back. We're talking about the Naknek Cannery and a history project to save the stories. And got great guests, so we'll be right back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and today we are talking about the Naknek Cannery and Bristol Bay and the importance of the Alaska Packers Association, and then the importance of actually the people that worked there a lot, because a big goal of this project is to save the stories and the memories and to a certain extent record and remember the buildings as they still stand at the Naknek Cannery. So we've got Katie Ringsmith, Tim Troll, and Andrew Abayo with us, and we're going to go back to talking a little bit about the workforce. And we're lucky because we have a recording. Katie's dad was a superintendent there from 79 to
97.
So really a huge career. And she has been recording him a little bit. So this goes to the people who kind of put the cannery to sleep when the season was over and woke it up again when it was time to get started. So Katie, tell us a little bit about what you know your dad, why this is important to you too.
Well, like I said, my dad, he was working in Alaska when I was growing up in Washington, and dad would always leave and go to Alaska every summer. And then as a kid, I got to come up, and, it was just a wonderful experience for a kid.
You'd come up in May?
Yeah, we'd go up in May when school got out, and then we'd stay, and then we, like the fish, would leave and head back to Western Washington where I grew up. And then eventually I started working in the cannery. And, I grew up in a little small town in Washington. And then all of a sudden I was working side by side with Filipinos. Yuki Wada ran the fish house. Bob Sasaki was in the egg house. I packed eggs with the Japanese. And certainly growing up playing with the kids who grew up in the local village. So I think that's been an important experience for me. To simply be around people who...
It was more international than your hometown, for
exactly.
sure.
Exactly. And then going on to school. And, I worked my way through college on the slime line. And I went all the way to a PhD because of the work that I did at that cannery. And then in 1996, my dad was in Florida. And he was in a boating accident. He was run over by a speedboat. In fact, he suffered severe head injuries, and he was at the University of Miami for a while. He was medevaced where he was at Harborview Hospital for 4 months recovering.
It was a devastating accident.
It was a significant accident. But what I remember is the people from Bristol Bay who came down to see him. And he couldn't even remember who most of the people were, but they all told stories. And in fact, because my dad was gone so long, and in many ways he was more of a boss than a dad, it was through those stories, the people who talked about the kind of boss he was, that's how I learned about who my dad was. And in the end, when we heard that Trident was going to close the cannery, this was our way to give back. It was a way to say, for all of those people, to thank them. Because at the end of the day, the doctors told me to bring back his short-term memory by igniting that long-term. And what my dad knew more than the ABCs or the months of the year was the flow of fish through his cannery. And so the more stories that I told, the more it brought him back.
Oh, so it's been sort of part of his rehabilitation, too.
It was absolutely that. So not only did I learn about the important history on a very personal level, but it gave me back my dad. So this is a way for me to give back to the people who gave me everything.
Yeah. Well, we have a recording from your dad, a couple of recordings from your dad, and we're going to listen to the one that's called Spring Fall Crew, where he's talking, just as we were a few moments ago, about the need to put the cannery to sleep after the fishing is done and to wake it up when it's time to start canning again. So he referred to this as his Spring Fall Crew. So let's give it a listen.
I also hired a lot of people, local residents, and they worked for me both in the spring and the fall. And they took and got my tenders up at Diamond O. And they had to haul them out every fall. And then we'd get up there and they'd be ready and get our boats ready to launch in the spring. And they had also put together all the bunkhouses and get them ready. So when we arrived at the cannery, we had warm, nice bunkhouses, and everything was clean, and the beds were made, and we had a lot of good people working for us that lived right there locally, and I was always real proud of the people that worked for me, because I was one of the few canneries in Bristol Bay that hired a lot of locals, and we end up playing basketball against each other when we were younger, a lot younger, and then we had picnics with them and with the fishermen, in addition to the local residents, and so a lot of my fishermen came from California, but a good share of them were right there. And we housed their boats or put them up, and the spring fall crew would take them out, haul them out with the crane, and take them in and put them in the warehouse. And then in the spring, they would do just the opposite. They would bring them out and they'd launch them, and they'd all be ready when the fishermen arrived in the cannery to go fishing.
Wow. Your dad, that recording is recent. So how old is your dad right now?
He's in his 70s.
Yeah, and he is going to be up here for an event related to this project. So let's talk a little bit about that so people have that date in mind. It's October 7th.
Yep, October 7th at the Palmer Train Depot. We're going to host what we call Mug Up. And so we have Bob King, who is, of course,
famous journalist. I recognize that.
Yes, in
name.
Fact, he was the station manager for KDLG, which was an important signature and just... it was a constant voice in Bristol Bay.
Sure.
And he's going to sit down and interview my dad. And again, they were contemporaries, but they never knew each other, even though, you know, my dad's job was, a lot of it was on the radio.
Your dad was on the radio because he was talking to the fishermen?
Talking to the fishermen and also placing all the tenders so that the fishermen had boats to deliver to, and then the tenders would take the fish and transport them to the canneries. And so we always had to make sure there was a balance. You didn't want too many fish, but you never wanted to stop production too. So having, you know, so it was always a balancing act, a juggling act in Bristol Bay. And it wasn't just his cannery. There were other canneries too that they were, and processors by that time too. But when Dad retired in 1997, he represented the last of the Alaska Packers superintendents. So Alaska Packers, although it dissolved in the 1980s, when he retired, he was it, because he started it, you know, when he was fairly young. So
Wow. Well, I also want to make sure we talk about the Spanish influenza. And I was thinking about this idea that the Alaska Packers Association was so strong in terms of jobs and the salmon industry, and also politics and as Katie brought up, statehood, all those kinds of issues. But there was one fairly golden moment for the canneries and the cannery hospital, which we haven't really talked about at the Naknek Cannery, when the 1918 Spanish flu hit Western Alaska in 1919. And I'm turning to Tim Troll because he has some amazing stories about that. And Tim, you can start wherever you want. I saw one picture that was very moving of two small children that were taken off a vessel that was adrift in Bristol Bay, and the adults on the boat had died, and they were orphans. And so it's a very chilling story to think about that, but there are others. So tell us a little bit about it in your own words.
Well, I first became aware of it when we had a mysterious gift arrive at the Sam Fox Museum in Dillingham back in the 90s from a family of a doctor who had been who had started Conaknek Hospital in Dillingham. And when I further contacted the family, found out that they had photographs. The doctor was a photographer. We finally got copies of all the photographs. And then among those, we just see these children, numbers of children. And then the connection came, Conaknek Hospital became an orphanage because of the flu, because of all the villages around Bristol Bay whose parents died in the flu, were taken by the flu. And the canneries were the ones that rescued them in many cases and treated the early victims of the flu when they arrived in Bristol Bay in May of 1919. The flu got into Alaska, as it did everywhere else, in 1918, and it was particularly devastating up around in the Nome area, Brevik Mission area as well, as it was around the state. But it was particularly bad in Bristol Bay. And the sad thing is you can read the correspondence, and they knew it was coming, what they were trying to do to keep it out, and they couldn't keep it out. And then, you know, back then, the only way you could reach people was by dog team or boat. So your resources were stretched. Even the doctors that the governor sent at the time out to help died with the flu. So the canneries brought up doctors every year to treat their own workers. They wound up being the first responders. And even when the government came in, the government boat was, the records are pretty horrendous. It was not a good government response. And had it not been for the canneries,
on the ground,
their willingness to reach out. And, you know, it did occur before the big run hit, which would have been in July. 1919 did turn out to be one of the worst years on record ever for Bristol Bay. So the canneries were the ones that responded. In the end, in the fall time, a lot of those orphans were then sent to Dillingham and Conaknek, where the orphanage was founded. And frankly, most families in Bristol Bay, if you're a native family, you may even begin your family all over again from those orphans in that flu, because the adult populations were pretty much wiped out. And then in the end, the state was struggling to get the money to pay for everything, because the Governor Riggs at the time, didn't have an appropriation to do this. And the Alaska Packers Association said, you know what, we don't need the money for what we did. It's just part of our service to the people, basically. Mm-hmm. So they never asked for any reimbursement from the government for all the work they did.
Wow, that's amazing. And am I right about that one picture of those kids that came off a boat from what was the village?
I don't know if it's a picture, but it's a story.
Oh, okay.
And it was definitely a true story.
She might have. She might have the picture
of the two kids.
Yeah.
Well, I have the story.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And actually, you can look on our website at the nncanneryproject.com, and we have the photograph. And then in the reports, the superintendents and the NN Cannery superintendent, they also ran Diamond O that Dad
right.
referred to,
mm-hmm.
and Diamond M, which was downriver, and he was writing his reports, and you almost get a sense of this happening at the time, the real time. And so he writes that also on this date, a sailboat drifted ashore near the Alaska Packers Association Diamond O Cannery at Naknek. Three small children suffering with influenza came up the beach and reported that two men were dead on the boat. The bodies were given a decent burial and the children taken to the Alaska Packers Association Naknek Hospital, where they recovered, and the boat was towed to the NN Cannery. So he's referring to the hospital at the cannery.
Hmm.
And then, you know, we have these other reports that talk about on May 30th, I made a trip to the Alaska Packers Association at the Ugashit Cannery, and that's where Andrew is from. He goes on to write, I found that the influenza had attacked the Ugashit natives, that practically the entire native population was stricken. Also sick were six white winter watchmen. The natives had died the previous evening. And then he goes on to talk about how the doctors were sent. On June 1, the chief nurse was sent to Ugashit with additional supply of medicine. While there, the chief nurse performed most excellent work in assisting the natives and the whites affected. And then he goes on to say that it was very important that everybody who was stricken with this illness was treated and cared for.
Mm, that's amazing. I'm just going to share our phone numbers just because I want to ask Andrew if some of that history is still talked about. But our number's in Anchorage, 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. Or you can send an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Andrew, growing up, how do people talk about the Spanish flu in that time?
So I never really heard any conversations about the Spanish flu. And the only thing that I learned about it on my own is just my own research, and to actually how I'm feeling right now is to be sitting here with Bob and Katie and to Tim.
Bob, we're thinking about you, but you're not here in this room.
And to your book, you have A Sailing for Salmon, is that
yes,
correct?
Yeah.
And I have that book, and it was a great resource for me, and your book also with Father Hubbard. That one also, very in-depth information.
Thank
so, and today you introduced this article with Ugashit included, and that's pretty amazing to hear. You know, mm-hmm. The only thing that I remember, and maybe Tim might know, is reading about the influenza hitting Pilot Point, Ugashit, and when I would. There was like only two survivors out of Ugashit. And for me to be from Pilot Point, Ugashit River District, you know, that's kind of, when I first heard that, it was pretty devastating. So to read and to, so this is just good for me, for myself to learn more about these people.
Well,
people.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Tim, anything else you want to add?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that the way this flu worked, and I don't know all the medical reasons for it, but it struck older people and very young, but the sort of the infants almost up to 13, 14 survived. Mm-hmm. So that's why there were an enormous number of orphans, not only here, but, you know, all around the state and
all
other places.
All around the state, yeah.
And the adult population, and particularly in that time and that place, it was the hunters that mm-hmm. died in that flu.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases. So families were not able to get sustenance.
Devastated, yeah.
So
yeah.
The orphanages became a necessity, and it was a real burden for the state to deal with this.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a tiny break right now. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. We'll be right back, and we've got some callers that we'll be getting to.
I'm good.
Thank you.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we were just having some sobering conversation about the way the influenza epidemic wreaked havoc, not only on the whole state of Alaska, but especially on Bristol Bay, which is the area we're talking about. We're talking about the cannery history, and we're talking about the NACNEC Cannery History Project. I've got Katie Ringsmith, Andrew Abayo, and Tim Troll with me in the studio, and we're going to go to a few questions. I'd like to welcome John on Hometown Alaska. Hi, John.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Hi. Very important project and subject you're discussing. I had the pleasure of listening to Tim lecture on it, and it's just so fascinating and so important. And I'm calling mostly to say I hope that after you're done in Juneau, that this exhibition will come to other parts of the state, including Anchorage and Fairbanks. And could you tell us a little more information about what's going to be happening in Palmer on October the 7th? Thanks so much.
Thanks, John. Okay, let's talk about the mug up again.
Oh, okay, yes.
And then talk about the potential for the exhibit. We don't know, but go ahead, Katie.
So, yes, on October 7th at 2 o'clock, we're going to have a mug up, which is about the traditional time you would have your afternoon mug up. And so we have Non-Essentials, which is actually owned by a Bristol Bay resident, Denise Smith-Schott. And she and another Bristol Bay former resident, Roxanne Shade, they're going to provide the mug-up treats. And so we're going to invite people to learn more about the project. Andrew is going to be there to show off what the model is going to look like.
The cannery.
So it's informative. It's also a way to kind of gather people who are the kind of the Bristol Bay expats, if you will, living in other places. And then also we'll have Bob King on hand to sit down and kind of have a conversation with my dad. But ultimately, what we'd love to have is more people who have these experiences be part of that conversation. And so we can get those recorded. The Palmer radio station is going to record it, and so hopefully that's something that can be broadcast other places. And ultimately, if it doesn't have to be this NN cannery, right?
Yeah.
That's the nice thing about these stories is that the cannery people existed all over Alaska and all the way down the Pacific coast, even connects us to places like China, the Philippines, and Japan. So what we would like to do is to extend these conversations. So if it doesn't have to be a Bristol Bay connection per se.
Okay.
Even if you know someone who, you know, worked in the cannery, we want to hear from you.
Save those stories.
Exactly. Yeah. We want this to become more central to our narrative as Alaskans. Yeah. And so that's happening on October 7th. Now, in terms
of the 2 o'clock at the Palmer Train Depot. Okay.
Absolutely. And in terms of the exhibit, right now we are in the process of raising money for this exhibit. This year alone, we've raised over $200,000 through donations.
You said it was grassroots.
All grassroots, yes. So I'm learning how to write grants. But we've been extremely successful, and we are very appreciative. But the idea is if we can raise more money, we would like this exhibit to travel. We are planning, we're curating it with the plans to travel. It'd be great if it could go to museums in rural Alaska, to places like Anchorage and Fairbanks. But ideally, I'd like to see it travel, you know, along the West Coast, across the nation, and even to places like China, the Philippines, because the people who contribute to this industry, they're a part of the story, too. This is a local story with global connections.
Right. And we do have on our alaskapublic.org, we've got your website link, and we've also got your Facebook link. So those are good ways to stay in touch, and maybe if people want to get involved or find a way to tell their story. I also would like to welcome another caller on. We have Denise from Palmer. Hi, Denise. Can you hear me?
Hi there. I sure can.
And welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Well, thank you so much. I just wanted to express my gratitude for this project. I feel like it's really a wonderful way to begin to tell this story and to maintain this story for the many, many people whose lives were impacted by some experience at the cannery, whether you were a worker or a fisherman, or in my case, a fisherman's daughter. I just think it's such a lovely, I'm so grateful for it. It's been exciting to meet people recently. I'm currently living in Palmer, and it's been very exciting to meet so many people who, when you begin to tell them about the project, they tell you their story of how they met their husband at a cannery on Kodiak, or how their granddad fished here or there. It's really a lovely,
so pervasive
connection.
Yeah, very pervasive. Now, you lived in Bristol Bay and grew up over there as the daughter of a fisherman?
I was raised at Bumblebee in South Naknek, just downriver from the NN cannery that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And my folks worked at Eacock Cannery, and I mean, fishing was very much a part of our family, and actually our family history in Bristol Bay started just after the flu. My Uncle Butch was taken ill while he was running mail from the Pacific side up to Bethel. A woman there treated him, kept him in her home. He married her, and they moved to Eacock, and that's how our family ended up in Bristol Bay.
Actually, wow. her
This your, is Tim. Go ahead.
Yeah, her uncle is Butch Smith, who's one of the classic characters of Bristol Bay. And he was there even. He was an old gold miner. He got there actually after the turn of the century. And, yes, he was one of those classic old fishermen, married local woman. And we love to hear stories about Butch Smith. And
well,
Roy, too.
I love those stories and that you know them.
So, Denise, are you involved in this Naknek project yourself at this point?
Very superficially at this point, but I'll tell you, had I known it was going on, I would have been so dug in deep, because it's such a delightful project. We're going to do some baking and cooking for the mug up here in Palmer, and I'm busy trying to let people know about it. But, yeah.
Mm. And, you know, Denise, why did so many people from Bristol Bay end up in the Matsu Valley? Seems like there's almost a like an expat kind of community there. Do you know why?
Well, I suspect that Anchorage is, for everybody, has been a little more expensive, a little, maybe a little bit less inviting. My folks moved up to Palmer, if anybody can believe this, because they chose the Butte because there wasn't a lot of wind after having been a winter watchman and a pilot for many years. My dad didn't want to be in the wind and found the Butte, which at that time didn't have a lot of wind.
Huh. That's great.
Well, one of the things, too, that Denise came up with, I mean, you might say superficial, Denise, but you are in deep. And she gave us one of the most brilliant ideas, and it came from Bumblebee. So Trident Seafoods not only owns the NN cannery, they also own the Bumblebee cannery. And Trident has donated to us hundreds of wooden corks that they have secured at Bumblebee. And the wooden corks is the old way they used to catch fish. And Denise came up with this idea as a way to honor and to remember many of these forgotten people, is that, and you can also support the cannery project. So you can actually purchase a cork, and we will engrave the person's name on the cork that you want remembered. So, for example, I got one for my dad. So I put Gary Johnson, the years he worked, the cannery he worked at, and the company he worked for. And then we're going to have Bristol Bay net hangers hang the nets, and they will then be on display as part of the exhibit. So, again, reminding people from all over the world that these are people's names who contributed to a very important industry, and their names should not be forgotten.
And you're going to see Chinese names and Japanese names and Mexican names and Portuguese names and Croatian names. I mean, Scandinavian
hopefully.
Names.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's the,
I mean,
but the idea
that's the
is
goal.
To, yeah. Yeah, to, and we don't know what it's going to be like. That's the great thing in all of this, and that's, you know, the artist sensibility is it will become something more than mm-hmm. probably what we had planned to do with it in the first place.
Now, can people find out about these corks on your website now? Is there a way to find?
We are, yeah, we're in the process of formulating that right now, but yes, they can.
Okay.
We are just getting this geared up for the October 7th event, but the idea is for people to be able to purchase a cork through the website. Mm-hmm. We'll get the names engraved, and then they will be and we'll send a certificate. It's also a tax deductible donation.
But it's kind of like a brick in the town square.
Yeah,
kind
we're
of thing.
Buying a seat for a theater or something like that. But and then it's also a way to add to the actual history.
Yeah, yeah. And back to you, Denise. Any other little cannery or fish life Bristol Bay stories you want to share?
Oh, nothing specific. I think it was so much just the regular thing. I know that I loved the activity. I loved the excitement. I loved knowing that such a high quality food was being produced. I still honor the fishermen as much as I possibly can.
Well, that's great. So again,
thank you so much.
Yes, thanks for calling in, Denise. Really appreciate that. And we'll remind people October 7th is the mug up at the Palmer.
It's free to get in, and it's.
Or you can have an open mic, like people can step up and tell stories.
Oh yeah, it's that's the whole storytelling is what we hope people we encourage people to do to add to the add to the story.
And then Bob King, who's a longtime fisheries journalist in Alaska. I remember him from my time here in the 80s, and he's going to interview your dad, Gary Johnson, who is the superintendent at NACNEC.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Something else. We've got still a little bit of time. We didn't even touch on this, but it kind of blew my mind when I was looking at your site and reading about it, because I came from San Diego, and the Star of India was a sailing vessel sitting in the port there, and I never really knew the history or that it connected San Diego to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Katie, one of your biggest missions or ambitions here is that people see the Bristol Bay canneries in a global context. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the Star Fleet, because people might not know about that. I connected with the Star of India in San Diego, but there were how many? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, the Star of Alaska is at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, big tourist site also, so likewise with San Diego.
Yeah.
And the Star Fleet were sailing ships, the square riggers that sailed ultimately from San Francisco to Alaska, bringing in the crews and the fishermen, and they'd make the cans aboard ship on the way up, and then they'd take all the product out. And again, this is a time when everybody's going to mechanical ships and steamships.
Huge transition.
Where Alaska Packers is still doing the sailing ships. Well, one, and they call them the Star Fleet, which sounds very romantic and grand.
It sounds like Star Trek.
Right. But they were cheap. They were on the market, and they could buy all of these ships cheap because they didn't need them. All they needed to do is get them up there, and then they sat idle for the summer, and then they just needed them to come back. So they really didn't need. So they had this Star Fleet, and again, all of these different people set sail and went north. Now, a place like San Francisco, the Maritime Museum does a terrific job of telling the story of what happens when people went to Alaska. But now we have an actual site that can communicate to visitors from all over the world what happened when they got here. Mm-hmm. And we can tell the actual stories and personalize them in a way that makes this a more common theme than people think it is. It's not just putting fish into a can. We all have a kind of an experience like this. And what's also great about this is if we do nominate it as a maritime site, we are working very closely with the National Park Service. And the National Park Service is also very close to the cannery via Katmai National Park. The same fish that those bears are catching at the park are the ones that the Bristol Bay fishermen are catching in their nets downriver. And so there's a shared history here. There's a shared story. And again, it's also tourism opportunities. So the local community might be able to tap some of the people coming from all over the world to go watch bears or, you know, to explore the Valley of 10,000 Smokes and come down, visit the local Bristol Bay Historical Society Museum, learn about the canneries, and then actually head out to Pilot Point or Peterson Point and maybe witness one of the great fisheries on Earth firsthand, and then go back and watch the bears.
So
what we're doing is not just simply trying to capture history. We're also trying to create a foundation that will help people who, quite frankly, are losing a big part of their economy with the closure of this cannery, helping them create opportunities for the future. We can't replace this cannery. And we can't even really, you know, restore
guarantee,
it in any way.
We can't guarantee that
we need a lot more than
there.
$200,000
yes.
to do that. Yeah. But yeah. What we can do is take the stories and try to figure out ways that we can create a kind of a humanities community around it.
Yeah. So right now, the property is still owned by Trident.
Mm-hmm. And Trident's been terrific and very supportive in all of this.
But there's no guarantee that these buildings will remain, right? Which is why Andrew's model is so important, because at some point that may be the only way that you actually see the footprint that was there. Yeah. You know, we have just a couple more minutes, but I was thinking about the mug up, and I read through the histories about how important food was and how important the kitchen was and how important the suites were. And I think there was some reference to a superintendent who hired or fired his baker based on their maple bars.
Yeah, that's my dad.
Was that your dad? So talk a little bit about that. And also there was a rhythm to the mug up. Like there was the first one at 10, and you know there was a whole rhythm that broke up the day in the cannery.
Yeah, these mess halls fed 500 people 7 times a day. I mean, you worked that long, so you needed that caloric intake just to keep going. You didn't sleep much.
Yeah.
And so you lived for food. I mean, you really did. That was how you dictated
carbs,
your life.
Carbs.
So you had a full breakfast in the morning. You had 10 o'clock mug up. That was pastries and coffee. At lunch, you had, full lunch, dessert. You also had to provide foods for the different ethnicities. So rice was a staple. It was very important to have a whole host of different types of food. And then you had 3 o'clock mug up, which were cookies, homemade cookies.
Gosh.
And then you had a full dinner, which oftentimes was prime rib or baked salmon. And and then you had a 9 o'clock mug up, which was sandwiches, cold
before
cuts
you go to
and
bed.
Things like that. Oh, don't wait. There's mug up at midnight.
Because you could still be working, right?
Midnight
the
meal.
The lines could still be running.
Yeah, especially when you're dealing with tides, because you have 22-foot tides twice a day, and you need to get your boats in, to the tenders, into that dock before the tide goes out. So you could be delivering, fish at 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. When the machine started at 8 o'clock, you needed to, feed the people, and you had to feed them fast. Yeah. So it was pretty extraordinary.
And how many, just roughly at the height, how many people were they feeding? 500, did you say?
Yeah, because then the fishermen would come in and eat.
Yeah.
So we are dealing with the cannery crew, and those are the people who I really want to tell the stories of. But I can't forget the fishermen either, because whether they were the sailboat fishermen who were cannery employees, or later when they became independent, they're still living there, they're still eating there, and definitely make up the cannery culture. And that's where you're getting the Croatians, the Italians, and certainly the Scandinavians, all of those experiences, too.
Yeah.
So the fishermen play a big part of this story, too, not to mention the Aleutic fishers and the Yupik fishers and the Unungan fishers, who were pretty darn good at what they did.
It's pretty amazing. It's amazing to me that I didn't know more about this history, but I'm so glad that the Naknek Cannery Project, NN Cannery Project, History Project, is ongoing. As you can hear the music, we are out of time. So we just have to say thank you. And, October 7th is a key date for the mug up in the Palmer train station. And I'd like to thank Katie Ringsmith, Tim Troll, and Andrew Abayo for joining me today, and our listeners and our callers. I'll be back as your host next Monday with Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, when we talk about therapeutic courts. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Thanks to Ammon Swenson and Dave Waldron in our studio today as our studio engineers. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.